1 Corinthians 8:1 through 8:3, the 22nd talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on July 13, 2003, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The summertime, which means it is that time of the year when I typically teach around here. For many years, I've had an inferiority complex because there's fewer people here in the summer than in the fall, and I was quite convinced that none of you loved me. But I've been working on it, and I'm getting better. I'm glad to see a reasonably full turnout this morning. I'm feeling much better about things. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? No. So, last time I was here, it was a long time, last time I taught here, it was about 7 months. We went through the first seven chapters of 1 Corinthians, which would indicate we went about a chapter a month, I guess. Today I'm going to pick it up in chapter 8. I'm sure you all remember what I said about the first seven chapters. But just in case there are a few of you that weren't here, let me give you a brief review of what's happening in the first part of 1 Corinthians. Paul, in his lifetime, made several what we refer to as missionary journeys, journeys where he went out into various regions of Asia and into Greece and Macedonia to found churches, to proclaim the gospel and start churches. On his second missionary journey, he went to Greece, to the city of Corinth, and he stayed there for about a year and a half. He founded the church there. They got to know him real well. He got to know them real well. And then he left, went back to where he had come from briefly, and then went out on his third missionary journey and spent quite a bit of time in Ephesus. It is while he is in Ephesus, having founded the church in Corinth, that he writes what we know as 1 Corinthians. It is a letter in response to various things that he has heard about what is happening in the Corinthian church. The relationship that Paul had with the Corinthians was rather contentious. There was a significant group in Corinth that was fighting Paul. They didn't really respect him. They didn't, at least it seems, the evidence seems to suggest that some of them, at any rate, would even deny that he was an apostle and did not put him in the same category as the other apostles. In the letter so far, in the first seven chapters, first of all, Paul deals with the foolish and worldly values that have led them to take sides in Corinth. Some of them are saying, we don't really like Paul so much, we like Apollos. We think Apollos is a much more impressive teacher. And evidently, Apollos was a very impressive speaker, a very powerful debater, and Paul, in contrast, was not seen to be so impressive as a speaker. And this has led some of them to say, Apollos is the one who demonstrates wisdom. He's the one who has the sort of wisdom that we respond to, because look at what a powerful and persuasive speaker he is. Paul reminds them that the gospel is the true wisdom, and that he is a divinely appointed messenger of that gospel. So the values that have led some of them to prefer Apollos to Paul are totally misplaced and worldly. Next, he basically chews them out over the way they have responded to an incident of sexual immorality in the church, and they have responded to it basically by not responding to it. And their failure, Paul argues, arises from their failure to take seriously the requirement that we pursue lives of holiness, including in the area of our sexuality. So Paul urges them to take seriously what we are called to and call the person that is engaged in the sexual immorality to account for what they're doing. Then, in the second half of the letter, which starts in chapter 7, I believe, Paul turns to a series of questions that the Corinthians have asked him. Evidently, they have written him a letter, and they have a series of problems that they're having in the church, and they're asking him to weigh in. What do you think? How should we resolve this stuff? All of the things they write him about, as far as I can tell, are not just theoretical questions. You know, hey, we were having a discussion the other day, and we were wondering how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and we were wondering what you thought about that, Paul. Each of the things that they're asking about are things that there are disagreements about in the church. There is contention. It is becoming a problem. And so they're really sort of asking Paul to weigh in and deal with the problem. What do you have to say to the various groups in this dispute? The first issue that he addresses, the chapter 7 starts with, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote." That's the phrase that indicates, now I'm turning to these questions that you wrote me. And the first one that he deals with is this problem that there are some hyper-spiritual people in Corinth who have rejected sex altogether. A person can't be holy and be involved in sexuality, including in marriage. And so there are those who are married who are saying to their partners, "I'm too spiritual to have sex with you anymore." And so Paul is being asked to speak to this issue. What are the relative merits of being single, of not engaging in sexuality versus practicing it? How do you sort that out? And so that's what chapter 7 is about. And Paul agrees up to a point that living single can confer certain advantages, but he also argues strongly that marriage is a good thing and that husband and wife have made a commitment to each other to be sexually intimate. Okay, so that's what he's dealt with so far in the letter. We're in that part of the letter where he's dealing with their questions. And chapter 8 starts with the second of the questions that they have asked him. It begins, "Now concerning meats sacrificed to idols." So, evidently and clearly, the Corinthians have asked a question about eating meat sacrificed to idols. And as we will see, once again, it is not just a theoretical question. They're not just saying, "So Paul, what do you think? You think we should eat meat sacrificed to idols or not?" We're a little confused on that. There is a problem. There is a dispute. There are those who believe firmly that it is okay to eat the meat, and there are those who think it is not okay. And they are looking at each other with derision and suspicion. So Paul is speaking not just to the issue of whether or not you should eat meat sacrificed to idols, but the attitudes that underlie that and the way they are interacting with each other as they address this issue. Now, before we launch into this, and I'll just warn you, we're not going very far today, but before we get started, let me just make a comment about the task ahead of us. I would imagine that none of us here has been offered any meat sacrificed to idols lately. So I could imagine that your response when you look at the section that we're going to be looking at would be something like, "Oh man, I hope he goes through this quickly so we get to something interesting." What are we supposed to do with a letter that was written almost 2,000 years ago that addresses a problem that we don't have? I mean, why are we here talking about this? Couldn't we just sort of wave our hands and say, "Well, that was interesting to them, but today we have other problems," and move on? Well, we're interested in this letter because Paul was inspired by God with a profound understanding of the gospel. That's why I'm trying to understand what he said. I think he knew what he was talking about the most important issues in life. And it is out of that understanding that he is addressing the issue of meat sacrificed to idols. What we are interested in is that picture of life that Paul had. What did he think was true? What did he think was important? And it is out of that picture of life that he is answering their question about meat sacrificed to idols. So, the task in front of us starts with what was happening back then. We want to know what was the issue that Paul is addressing as clearly as we can so that we don't misunderstand what he's getting at. Then we want to try to understand specifically what does he say to them about it? What do his words mean? We want to interpret what he said. And then we want to ask ourselves why he said it. That is, what principles and truths led him to say the things that he did to the Corinthians? Why would he tell them to do X and not Y? Many times his explanation will be there in the text. Sometimes we will have to work to find why is he telling them this. It is then, finally, when we have gone through that process, that we're in a position to understand how he looked at the situation and to apply those principles and truths to our own situation, which may be very different. So, yes, this process involves things that at first don't seem immediately relevant to me. Eating meat sacrificed to idols is not immediately relevant to me. I have to understand issues that people had years ago, people who are now dead, and I have to understand the words and sentences that were written in Greek almost 2,000 years ago to an issue that is not mine, to people who are now dead. I have to do theology, try to understand what it is that Paul was thinking, what was his theological outlook that led him to say these things. And then I get to the good stuff, in the sense that I get to that question of what does this have to do with me? So I just want to say up front that ultimately I think the three chapters that we're going to be looking at, 8, 9, and 10, where Paul addresses this issue of meat sacrificed to idols, and I would argue that 8, 9, and 10 are one coherent section. We'll see as we go along. But in this section, it is not just about meat sacrificed to idols. It is about what our ultimate values ought to be. It is about the relationship between freedom and responsibility. There are a lot of important ideas that we're going to be exploring in this section. So I just want to say up front, many of you know what I'm saying already. I mean, if you've been around here a while, you know what sort of thing we're going to be doing when we approach a passage like this. But I just want to emphasize up front that just because this on the surface is about something that doesn't seem immediately relevant to us, the fact is that if we can come away with a clear understanding of what Paul is getting at here, we're going to be in a position to understand our own situation better. That's what I believe. So that's why I'm going through the trouble of trying to explain what I think is happening in these verses as we go along. Even though this is in some ways a dead issue, and certainly all of the people involved are dead at this point. Now, I'm only going to look at a couple of verses today, because the issue that is raised at the beginning here is an important issue. I think it's an important issue for us as a church. And so I want to slow down a little bit and look carefully at what he says as he opens up this topic. He says, "Now concerning meat sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone thinks that he knows something, he has not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he has been known by him." Now, it's significant, I think, that although the topic is meat sacrificed to idols, Paul does not start talking about meat. He does not start talking about idols. He starts talking about knowledge. And that's because knowledge and the uses of knowledge are very much at the heart of what Paul's concerned with in this section. Let me explain what I think the basic issue is in this section. We will see it as we go through, as he explains it, but let me set us up as we start. In Corinth, there are various temples to various pagan gods where people came and made offerings of meat to the gods. Well, what happened to the meat? Of course, the gods aren't there to actually eat it. So what happens? Some of it is burnt up. Some of the meat that is offered is then, by the temple, sold in the marketplace. If you went to buy food in the marketplace in Corinth, you would find meat for sale there, much of which had come from the temples where meat had been offered to the idols. Now, furthermore, although this is more debated, there does seem to be some evidence that at the temples, at least some of them, there were dining rooms set up. And at those dining rooms, the people of the community would come and have meals together. It was kind of like going out to eat at a restaurant. Only it was connected with the temple. There were certain religious things associated with it. Everyone knew this is a communal meal that is involving the celebration of Apollo or whoever it is that we happen to be celebrating at this temple. But I think it's likely that the scenario is that in many ways this had become as much a social event as a religious event. That people would go to the temple, there's everybody from town, and we have a nice meal there together at the temple, at the dining rooms in the temple. So, like I say, there is some debate about exactly how this picture works, but I think something like that was probably going on as well. Okay. So this is the scenario in which the Corinthian Christians find themselves. Many of these Christians were Gentiles who had been in the habit all their lives of participating in the rituals at the temples and going to the communal dining rooms and eating. And so they had a great deal of experience with the religious side of this meat sacrifice to idols. The situation now is this. Some of the Corinthians have rightly enough argued that, look, these idols are not real. There are no real gods behind these idols. So meat that's been sacrificed to idols is just meat. It doesn't have any property that when you put it in your mouth it turns you into an idol worshiper or something like that. It's just meat. So we're free to eat it. And certainly they felt free to buy meat at the meat market that was meat that came from the temples that had been sacrificed to idols. Certain comments that Paul makes suggest that they may as well feel free to go and participate in those communal meals at the temples. That they would argue, look, we know that there's nothing to this. This is a great place to get a meal. You see everybody. So we're going to go and eat dinner at the dining rooms of the temple. Even though we don't believe in the idols that are involved here, we are going to go out to dinner when we want. There's debate about that part of it, but I think at this point it's likely that there is some of that going on as well too. Okay. And then there are those in the community who do not feel this freedom and in fact would argue that that's an inappropriate thing to do. That is involving yourself with idolatry. And we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't involve ourselves with idolatry. We would become idolaters by eating this meat and especially going to the temple and eating there. So this seems to be the debate that is happening in Corinth. This is the issue that is one of many issues that is dividing them in the church. Now, as I said, the argument of those who feel the freedom to eat the meat seems to be this. We know that there is no real God behind the idols. There is only one God. Yeah, those people there who are worshiping those gods, they think they're worshiping someone real. But we know that they are not worshiping someone real. that God is not real. There is only one God. Now, if we were intending to worship other gods, that would be bad. But we are not intending to worship other gods. We just want to eat. We just want to have a meal. So this is just good, honest meat. The fact that it was sacrificed to idols before I ate it doesn't change the meat. It's just meat. And we know when I take this meat and eat it, I have knowledge of what I'm doing. I know there is no idol. There is no real God that has accepted this meat as a sacrifice. There is only one God. So it's just meat. So in my knowledge of what is true, I have the freedom. I see in the truth of that that I have the freedom to eat the meat because there is nothing wrong with the meat. So, worshipping idols is bad. Eating meat is not bad. That's the way they would present it. And it is their knowledge that there is nothing wrong with it that makes it okay for them to eat it. Okay. So that's why Paul starts out talking about knowledge right off the bat, because he's responding to their argument that our knowledge that the idols are fake gives us the freedom to eat the meat. It is that knowledge that is the basis of our decision about what we're going to do. I know that it's okay. I know that there is nothing intrinsically wrong with the meat, therefore I'm free to eat it. And what Paul's going to do in this section is argue that the knowledge that I have the right to eat the meat is not enough. I have to ask what effect my freedom is going to have on others. Now, ultimately, I'm sure many of you are familiar with where Paul is going to go is the famous argument about the weaker brother. What sort of obligation do I have in my conduct, even though I know the truth of something, that I have a freedom to do certain things, how do I exercise that freedom in the light of the fact that there are other Christians who do not believe in that freedom? How do I decide what I'm going to do? And that's the issue, at least one of the issues, that is going to come up in this section. But today, we're not going to actually explore Paul's rationale for that. I want to talk about what he says about knowledge here. That's the part that we want to explore today, and then we'll get into the weaker brother stuff next time. Okay. But just as we start into what we are about to look at here, basically what Paul is going to say is that I cannot elevate the knowledge of my rights above my obligation to love my brother. And that what all they have done in their argument is say, we know that we have the right to do it. And Paul wants to argue that the knowledge of the right to do it is not enough. There's more at stake. Okay. So, now concerning meat sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. It's quite likely here that Paul is responding to these arguments that have been made to him. Paul, we're in the right here. We know there is nothing to this idol stuff. We know that there's no real God here. So we are perfectly within our rights to do this. I'm a little embarrassed to say that a simple phrase like, we know that we all have knowledge, I'm not exactly certain in my mind yet how to understand exactly what he means by that. There are different ways that you could take it. It doesn't substantially affect his argument, but I think maybe he means something like, yes, I'll grant you that you and I have knowledge about whether idols are real, something like that. If you have questions about that, we can go into it. I decided not to go into all of the ins and outs of my thinking about this phrase because it would just confuse you, as it has me. But basically, what we can see is what he's starting out to address is the fact that they see themselves as having knowledge about the idols, the meat sacrificed to idols. And that knowledge is the basis of their conduct. He wants to dispute this. He wants to argue that knowledge is not enough, that there's something else that has to be considered. Interestingly, he is not going to argue that their knowledge is wrong. He's not going to disagree with them about their perspective on the idols. He shares their perspective as far as it goes, that the idols are nothing and that we have the right to eat the meat. There is nothing intrinsically wrong with eating this meat. He agrees with that. But his attitude in this is basically going to be, so what? So what if there's nothing intrinsically wrong with eating it? That in and of itself doesn't tell me what I ought to do, because there's more at stake than just the question, do I have the right to eat it? Okay. So about this knowledge that they say they have, he says, knowledge puffs up. Knowledge makes arrogant. But love builds up. Now this is a very interesting sentence, and we need to be careful. I think this is a classic case of how important it is to understand a verse in the context of the overall argument. I think that Paul's statements about knowledge in this section have been greatly distorted at times by people who want to argue that Paul is dismissing knowledge and putting love in its place. This verse by itself can sound as if Paul is asking us to choose between them. Which are you going to go for? Are you going to go for knowledge, or are you going to go for love? I mean, which is, you want to just like know stuff, or are you going to love people? This is the contrast that sometimes people present. You can do one or the other. You can know and understand things, or you can love. And if you seek to know and understand, then you're arrogant, and it will make you arrogant. If you try to know things, that will make you arrogant. But if you love, then that will build others up. So, perhaps in the light of that then, I should come here and say, let's just forget about trying to understand what Paul says in this letter, and let's just love each other. Well, I think if you think about it a minute, you can see that that makes no sense. Unless Paul is deeply schizophrenic, there's no way that Paul can be the sort of person who would be arguing that knowledge is unimportant. He is imparting a great deal of knowledge in this letter. He is making arguments, sophisticated arguments about a number of topics. He's making rational arguments, intending to persuade the Corinthians to believe and follow the truth. He wants them to know the truth and to know the difference between truth and error. Is he somehow making rational arguments against listening to rational arguments? No, that doesn't make any sense. So it doesn't make any sense to see Paul as making a sweeping statement that knowledge in and of itself makes you arrogant, love builds up. So therefore, stop pursuing knowledge and start pursuing love. That's not what he means. Remember the situation. Remember the kind of knowledge that he's talking about here. People are saying, I am perfectly justified in eating whatever I want because I have knowledge. I know that the idols are no big deal. My knowledge is superior to yours. You think that eating the meat is wrong, but I know that it is right. So my knowledge is superior to yours. I'm better off than you because I know better than you do that I have the right to eat this meat. And so I'm going to eat this meat because you're wrong about it and I'm right and I know that this is the case. This is the kind of knowledge that Paul's talking about. He's going to argue that even though their knowledge is accurate, their behavior is destructive because it is arising from wrong motives. So by knowledge here, Paul means something like knowledge for its own sake separated from values. It is knowledge that has become the justification for doing what I want, even though, in fact, a fuller understanding of God and His values would lead me to understand that I ought to do something different. The free thinkers in the Corinthian church are motivated by two things. They want to be free to eat whatever they want to eat, and they know that there are no real idols, so their knowledge is telling them that there is nothing intrinsically wrong with eating this meat. They want to eat the meat, and they have the knowledge that it's okay to eat the meat. What they have not asked themselves is whether love for their brothers should lead them to refrain from eating it, even though they want to eat it and they know they have the right to eat it. It is this kind of knowledge that Paul is talking about. It is knowledge by itself, in the service of self-interest, thinking ourselves superior in understanding to those who lack this knowledge. It is that kind of knowledge that puffs up. If I think about the situation strictly in terms of I know better than you, then that leads to arrogance. And he's right about that. He's perfectly right about that. On the contrary, love is concerned with building up. It's not just I'm in the right so I can do what I want, but what is the effect of my actions going to be on you? Caring about the impact of what I do on others. That's the contrast that Paul's making here. He says, if anyone thinks that he knows something, he is not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he has been known by him. Again, taken by itself, out of context, this verse could lead to some strange conclusions. If anyone thinks he knows something, doesn't that apply to everyone? I mean, doesn't everybody think they know something? I think I know something. I think I know a lot of things. Doesn't Paul think he knows something? I mean, his letters read like a person who's pretty confident about what he knows and is arguing what I know is true. And if you think differently, you're wrong and I'm right. I mean, that's the way Paul writes. That's the way Jesus talked. I mean, all of the biblical authors present themselves as knowing the truth and in opposition to other perspectives which are false. So, clearly Paul cannot mean that it is wrong to think that you know something, to think that you understand the truth about something. And certainly he is not going kind of all vaguely mystical on us and saying, we may think that we know things, but all our so-called knowledge is just an illusion or something like that. That is not Paul's thinking. There's no evidence at all that Paul thinks anything like that. In this context, Paul is clearly addressing that cocky, arrogant attitude that says, I can ignore you because I know the truth and you don't. If you think you know something, it's like if anyone thinks he is superior because of his knowledge, or if anyone thinks that he's justified in doing what he wants just because he knows something about it. Anyone who has that cocky idea that, hey, I've got it scoped out, I know that I have the right to do this, that's the sort of thing that he's talking about. If your basic stance is, I know what's going on, therefore, that justifies me in doing what I want to do here. It is that arrogant attitude that he's talking about. If I put the emphasis on the fact that I have this knowledge that gives me the right to do what I want, then I have not known as I ought to know. My knowledge is not being used in the way that God intends us to use our knowledge. But if anyone loves God, he has been known by him. The free thinkers in Corinth are saying, I know it is all right to eat meat sacrificed to idols because I have knowledge about God. I know that God is one. I know I'm a monotheist. I know that there aren't all of these gods out there. So I know better than to think that there's some idol out there that this meat is being sacrificed to. I know God. Ask me about God and I'll tell you the answer. He's like this. Okay, Paul is making the contrast. Okay, you know about God, but do you love him? Do you want to be like him? Do you want to learn his values and pattern yourself after him? Are you seeking him and his way of living? Is that what you want, or do you want something else? You may know about God, but the one who loves and seeks after God has gone you one better. He doesn't just know God, but more importantly, God knows him. And Paul turns this ironic sort of twist on it. The issue in the end isn't whether I know God in this sense, that I know all about him. The more important issue is whether God knows me. That is, am I one of his people? Am I one in whom his spirit is working? Am I one who loves him because he is at work in my life? Does he know me? And the phrase for God to know someone in the Bible usually is referring to being one of God's people. It's like what we see when Jesus tells the parable about, in the end, him saying to people, I never knew you. He doesn't mean that I didn't know you existed, but I didn't know you. You were not mine. So the contrast that Paul wants to make here is between knowing about God and loving God, knowing about God and being known by God. The free thinker is boasting that he doesn't need to listen to or consider the people who disagree with him on this stuff. I know I am in the right. And in fact, they are in the right as far as it goes. But they're using that right to say, I can ignore these guys. I don't have to consider how they think about it because I know I'm in the right. I know all about God, so I have every right to do what I want. Paul is raising a serious question here as to whether their lack of love in the way they are exercising their freedom calls into question whether they really love the God that they say they know. They know about God, but they don't seem to love their brother, and they don't seem to love God. That's the contrast that he's making in this section. And the issue is centered around how they are responding to these people who disagree with them on this issue. So my paraphrase of this last of these verses would be something like this, and I reserve the right to change it. Every time I sit down and read this, I think, oh, no, that's not quite right. But this is as far as I got. Now, concerning your question regarding meat sacrificed to idols, I know that some of you are justifying your behavior by saying that you know all about the idols and that everyone knows that idols are phony. And while I will grant you the truth of that, such knowledge is not enough. Remember, thinking that you are superior because of your knowledge only inflates your opinion of yourself, whereas love, our true calling, is intended to build up the other guy. If someone thinks he knows the truth and is therefore justified in ignoring those who disagree and doing what he wants, he is not using his knowledge in the way God intends. But if anyone loves God as opposed to just knowing about God, then not only does he know God, but more importantly, God knows him. Okay, so I have a few comments that I want to make about his opening verses here. Paul's exploring some very important themes regarding knowledge about God, arrogance, the love of my brother, and the love of God. In particular, there are these three relationships that Paul is talking about. And this is sort of in reverse order to the way he does them in the verses. He's comparing the knowledge about God versus the love of God, the knowledge about God versus love of my brother, and the knowledge about God and its connection with arrogance. So I just want to say a few things about that for a minute. Especially because this is a church, obviously, that puts a lot of emphasis on teaching. That is, we put a lot of emphasis on knowledge about God. And so it seems to me that these are very important themes for us to be thinking about. So let me talk about this contrast, knowledge about God versus the love of God. On the one hand, Paul is giving a very necessary warning here. There is an important distinction between correct theology and personal submission to God. We all know that theology can be correct and yet stubbornly incomplete. That's what's happening in Corinth. The free thinkers know that there is only one God, and they are right, but they have no desire or willingness to understand how much he values love and self-sacrifice for others. They don't really want to know him as he is and pursue living in the light of his values. They are boasting in their knowledge, but we could say in one sense that they don't know enough. Why don't they know enough? Because they don't really want to know enough, because they don't really love God. That is, they don't long to know him better. They don't long to be like him. They don't desire him and his promised kingdom above everything else. They have set something else as a value other than God and his values. It is very important, I think, that we guard ourselves against this. In a community like this, you know, for instance, that we teachers around here emphasize a lot the sovereignty of God. God choosing those whom he will save, God working in our hearts so to change us in a way that we can't change ourselves, and all of those sorts of issues. I have had the experience of encountering people who excitedly agree with us about the sovereignty of God, and then it comes to turn out to be that they really want to use that theology as a way of hiding from their responsibility to pursue faith and holiness in life. Yes, God is sovereign. He does it all, and I can do nothing. Therefore, I have no obligation to do anything. And I'll just wait for God to do something about it, and meanwhile, I'll do what I want. Well, the theology is correct, I would say, as far as it goes, that God is sovereign. But the implications of the theology and the decisions we make about how we're going to live are wrong, because there are other truths that we don't want to know. We don't really want to be under obligation to come to know God as he is. So, even great and important truths can become the means to distance ourselves from the God who is really there. And so this is a warning that we need to take to heart around here. Just because we may say something that's true about God from time to time doesn't mean that we personally have made that decision to submit ourselves to the truth and to be willing to change our minds about the way we live because of the truth of God. That is a choice that people have been facing throughout history. And we all are aware of people who, as you look at their lives through history and maybe people we know now, that they know the truth about God in a certain sense, but they don't love him. They don't really want to take their lives and change it in the direction of what God is all about. But on the other hand, I want to be careful. I deny that Paul is pitting the knowledge of God against the love of God. He is arguing against us arrogantly using selective knowledge about God to justify ungodly ways of living. But ultimately, the love of God and the knowledge of God must go together. Just as the knowledge of God is not real knowledge without loving God, so the love of God is not real love without the knowledge of God. You can't really claim to love God without seeking to know about him. There's no virtue in being ignorant about God, in making up a God who doesn't exist and then loving him. And nothing in the Bible would suggest that that's true. So what we don't want to do is to selectively use our knowledge of God to hide from God. But at the same time, we must seek to know him. And Paul is not denying that here. The same is true when we think about the knowledge of God versus the love of my brother. On the one hand, we know that we human beings fall into self-centeredness and arrogance very easily. Some of the Corinthians are using their theology to justify unloving behavior to their fellow believers. And the history of the church is filled with such examples. I mean, sometimes it is tragic to read how often Christians have used the knowledge of correct theology as an instrument with which to wound other people. And it still goes on today. I can't claim to have good theology ultimately, a truly biblical worldview, if my theology is being used to justify a lack of love. A primary value of God, and what should be a primary value for us, is loving even my enemies, that is, seeking the good of everyone. I am going to conduct myself in such a way that I am seeking your welfare always. I am never seeking your hurt. I am always seeking your good. That is what I've been called to, and that is what you have been called to. Theological knowledge can be used to hide from our obligation to love each other. And I cannot imagine that you cannot think of an example of that on your own, because the world has been filled with it from the beginning. And just look around today. On the other hand, I deny that Paul is pitting the knowledge of God against love, as if you can either have knowledge or love, but not both. Paul is against the attitude, my theology is right and yours isn't, so I am justified in treating you unlovingly. But it is not unloving to pursue the truth about God. We do not want to make the mistake of saying that coming to know the truth and proclaiming the truth and even disagreeing with those who say something different, we don't want to fall into the trap of thinking that it is unloving to do that. Ultimately, to call people to believe in the truth is loving. Every biblical author at times is very strong in their language against those who proclaim ideas contrary to the gospel. It comes together in that we say, yes, you have committed yourselves to ideas that are against the truth, that are against the gospel, that are against the fundamental truths of God. And so you have made yourself an enemy of the truth. And this needs to be made clear. But I know that I have an obligation to love those who are my enemy. And therefore, I am going to try to seek your good. Finally, that connection between not the knowledge of God and arrogance we need to understand. On the one hand, it is absolutely true that our self-centeredness easily leads us to think highly of ourselves, especially when we think we know something about God that others don't know. We in this community have to take this potential problem very seriously. Because any of you who have been around here for very long know that we are making so bold as to say, the gospel is this and not this. We are saying, you know, there are a lot of voices in the world, and a lot of voices that say, I'm with Jesus. But you know, not every voice that says, I'm with Jesus, is in fact with Jesus. We have taken a bold stance on that, and we often say, you will hear people say something like this, but it's not true. This is the truth instead. It is very difficult to take a stance of saying, I understand the truth of this, and those people do not, without falling into being arrogant about it, without thinking highly of yourself in the process. And I seriously doubt whether anyone who has been a part of this community for very long and who has actually embraced the vision of what we think the gospel is around here, I have a hard time believing that you have not at one time or another fallen into thinking highly of yourself because of it. And I know that I have had to struggle against that myself. I know this sounds like a strange thing to say, but I am a person who in life has encountered many problems. I have many weaknesses. I have a great deal to regret about what I am as a human being and what I have done as a human being. And my weaknesses and failures have been a kind of a blessing in a sense, in that they have been helpful to me in not getting too swelled ahead about myself. Because whenever I start to think highly of myself, I look at myself and I go, well, I guess we can't do that. I'm not saying I have not avoided the problem, that I have avoided the problem. I am sure that I have thought too highly of myself at times. But I actually have been glad in a way in my life that so many things have been screwed up because it keeps me from getting the idea that somehow I have it all together. Well, I pray that God would bless you with as much failure as He has me, so that none of us would think too highly of ourselves. But what I'm saying is we have to think seriously about this in this church, because I believe that we are committed to things that are true here, and I believe that some of the things that we believe are important, and they are different than some of the voices that you will hear out there. And to make that distinction is important. To make the distinction between truth and error is important. And yet, as Paul is telling us here, it is so easy for there to be a connection between knowing the truth, especially when I know something that somebody else doesn't, which is what was true in Corinth. They knew that there was nothing wrong with eating the meat, even though some of those other people thought there was something wrong. It is easy for that knowledge to translate itself into arrogance, to think, I am hot stuff because I know this. So, we don't want to become selective in our knowledge, where we think, I know the right theology, but I've forgotten the truths about myself, my evil, my guilt, my equal standing before God with everyone else, my obligation to love, and all of that. It's very easy for that to happen. And we have to think seriously about that, because we as a group are taking a certain stance and saying, this is the truth. And whenever you say, this is the truth, the temptation is to say, and I'm the one who knows it, and you guys don't. And to feel hot because of it. On the other hand, there is not an inevitable connection between the knowledge of God and arrogance. Paul and every other biblical author make it clear, time and again, that it is not arrogant to stand for the truth. It is arrogant to stand for the truth and think you're better than others. It is arrogant to stand for certain truths and to think that you can avoid your obligation to love others because you know the truth and they don't. But it is not arrogant to say, this is the truth, and what you have just said is a lie. That is not arrogant. It could be, but it doesn't have to be. So, Paul is not against the knowledge of God. He is not anti-theology. No one could read his letters and seriously think that he is anti-theology. What he is against is using my theology to justify my own arrogance and hide from the truth about myself. He's against using my theology to justify ignoring my obligation to love. He is against using my theology as a smokescreen to hide the fact that I don't really love God. I don't really want to know Him or submit to Him at all. Okay, so that didn't go very far today, but I thought that was an important theme in these letters. I wanted to clarify as much as I could. So, If you have any questions or comments, this would be a good time to bring them up. Logan has one.
Would it be safe to say that Paul would be prone to say, look, you want to eat, you know, you want to go downtown and eat at one of these booths in spite of the fact that it was sacrificed to idols, go ahead. But if you want to go downtown and eat at one of these booths because it is sacrificed to idols, I'll deal with that in chapter 10.
Yes, you're right, Logan. Both of those themes are going to come up, though. I think there's a twofold problem, at least, that he's going to be dealing with. One of them is the lack of consideration as to what my actions are, effect my actions are going to have on other people. But the other one is that sort of, I'm blasé about eating the meat sacrificed to idols because actually I'm kind of dabbling in that idol stuff a little bit. I think it's kind of cool to be involved with that. That sense of my freedom is not just based in knowledge about God, but it's also I enjoy having this sense that I can go and eat this idol meat. That's kind of daring or something like that. Both of those are significant themes, and both of them are going to be important for us to talk about because they're both very relevant to how we conduct ourselves in a lot of ways, I think.
I'm one of those Christians who tends to, unfortunately, like to believe in magic. So this magical thinking of, you know, well, okay, it's been sacrificed to idols. Whoa. And so I don't know. I guess I'm thinking, well, what would be your thought on combating thoughts like that?
Well, honestly, my first thought is, in my own life, the best way I know to combat thinking like that is to try as clearly as I can to understand what the biblical authors thought about it. That I have gotten an impression of what it means to be a Christian by living in the world and by what I hear various people say. What has been very liberating for me is to go back and to try to check that impression against what the biblical authors actually argue. So I think this section, chapters 8, 9, and 10 of 1 Corinthians, is very helpful in sorting that out. So in a way, I guess my answer would be, stay tuned to, you know, what we're going to be seeing as Paul's perspective on this as we go through. We haven't really seen much of that yet. I mean, he's talking about knowledge and arrogance and that as a prelude to what he's going to specifically argue about this issue, but we haven't really seen his specific argument yet. The best thing that I know to do is to try to understand what Paul was thinking about this. And I'm a big believer in combating the negative by replacing it with the positive, in general terms. That is, combating error not just by saying, that's wrong, but by building a new picture of what's right that ultimately pushes the other away. Just as in my own life, battling against sin is not, it is good to say, yes, that's wrong, but it is important for me to be building up a positive picture of what is it that God is calling me to that gives me perspective on why that is wrong. So I guess my advice is to be working on building up a new worldview, a biblical worldview, which may be new in certain extents. I don't want to say new that's going to replace everything that you ever thought, but you know, to try to become confident in my picture of the way things are. And the more I get that picture together, the more that is going to help push aside things that may be based in another worldview. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. Thanks.
Yeah. We might have time for one more if we want to. Up here.
The more I think about this, I seem to come to some sort of conclusion that these might be two different scenarios. But when you started talking about the people eating the meat that was sacrificed, I started thinking about when Jesus would sit down with the prostitutes and tax gatherers, and the Pharisees admonished him for that.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be that, you know, Jesus was correct in knowing that he had the right to sit down with them and that it was okay for him to do that. Not only that, but he then gave the Pharisees a proverbial slap across the face by saying, those who are not sick don't need a doctor. That's why he didn't, you know,
right,
sit with them.
Right.
But they seem, in a few ways, they seem to be somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm.
With the obvious differences that it's Jesus doing this,
right,
and it's the Pharisees, you know, who as a whole probably didn't, you know, at least what we see, didn't have a heart for God anyway.
Right.
Are there any similarities here aside from?
Oh yes, I think so. What we're going to see later on in 1 Corinthians is Paul describing his own conduct, the way he as a Jew, when he is with people who are not Jews, he feels the freedom to not be Jewish in the way he eats and so on. See, I think the connecting issue is, what is the motivation behind what I'm doing? Jesus knows that he has the right to be with those people, but furthermore, he's doing it to seek them out. He's doing it out of love. The people in Corinth know that they have the right to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, but they're pursuing it selfishly because they want it and they don't care whether it has a bad impact on anybody else. So the thing that ties them together is, I can, in my pursuit of the gospel, sometimes be very outrageous in terms of some people's perspective about what's right and what's not right. We have a great freedom in the gospel that can lead us to places that people who don't recognize that freedom can get very uncomfortable with. The question about whether I exercise that freedom, though, I think in the end is tied to, how do I see the impact of what I'm doing? In Jesus' case, he is seeking to edify the people that he is exercising that freedom with. In Corinth, they are ignoring the implications of their behavior for everyone else. So yeah, I think they're actually very closely tied together.
So Jesus wasn't seeking to hurt the Pharisees because they were already lost?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. See, Jesus and what he did offended the Pharisees. And not uncommonly, the Pharisees, somebody would say to Jesus, you know, you offended the Pharisees in what you said there or what you did. The issue that we're talking about here is not offending people. It's not, I have an obligation as a Christian not to offend people. And we'll see that as we go along. I mean, we haven't looked at the verses that really are going to tell us how to look at this stuff yet. We're just getting started. But the issue is not, I as a Christian need to be careful that I don't offend people. That's not it. I need to be careful that I love people. And sometimes offending people is an important part of loving them. And that's true in the way that Jesus dealt with the Pharisees. It would not have been loving to support the Pharisees in their self-righteousness. So he was not at all concerned about offending them. And that's an important distinction that we're going to be exploring as we go through this, because that gets a lot of Christians confused, I think, thinking that what the Bible is saying, what Paul's saying in these very passages, is I shouldn't offend anybody. No, I don't think so. Okay, well, thanks. We will continue next week.